This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show with an artist who's got a show of her own opening at Minnesota State University Moorhead's Gallery in the Dill Center for the Arts, and a distinguished career. We're going to talk about all of this with Carrie Pickett. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Doug.
Last year you were given the Lifetime Achievement Award from MSU Moorhead School of Art. That's a pretty big deal, and it's obviously because you've got a body of work that is impressive, to say the least.
Thank you. Well, you know, 40 years, it adds up.
Yes, it does. And you've got one that's opening, again, as I mentioned, at the gallery called Track Record, which I guess sort of looks at those 40 years.
I wanted to show the students my work from college through to today. So it's a very large show. It's I kind of look at it as a sample platter of my career, because a lot of bodies of work are large and I have a small amount of them representing in the show. But I really have a lot of work in the show, and including my college work, some of my college work.
Well, before we get into the specifics of what might be found in the show, let's give a bit of your career arc. Give us that elevator speech that is the story of Carrie Pickett.
Oh, well, I went to MSU. I was a graduate from 1982, and then I moved to New York City, and I got an internship with the Village Voice newspaper.
Not bad.
Under the direction of the legendary photographer Fred W. McDara, and I had a front row press pass to New York in the 80s, which was a good time to be there.
And from then?
And then from then, I went on to work through the 90s for People magazine. I worked for People magazine for over a decade. And then I worked for a lot of the national news magazines, Time and Newsweek and Fortune and all of those kind of things. And then I got a commercial gig. And that commercial gig allowed me to have a steady income, and then I used that steady income to become a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker.
And you made a couple of documentary films,
I've made two feature films.
Including one that we've talked about on our show, the First Daughter in the Black Snake with Winona LaDuke.
Yes.
Well, let's get into the sort of the psyche of Carrie Pickett, photographer here, because you mentioned People magazine, Life magazine. What are you looking for when you're making a photograph?
I'm a human interest person. I'm interested in our commonalities, the things that we share, and what makes us different from one another, but also primarily, I think, what brings us together, the common rituals of life and the commonalities of family and community. And so over time, I would say I'm very interested in how one person can make a difference. But I'm also just really family focused.
Well, what draws you to a creative project that isn't some assignment? You know, People magazine, photo editor saying, go get a photograph of this person. What gets you going?
Well, one of the things you'll notice in the show is that there's really the only assignment work in the show is some of my Village Voice work from the 80s. And I really wanted to see some of that myself and had never seen it before. But I really have always believed in personal work, and I believe in books. I really like books, and I think filmmaking is a book come to life. But what motivates me is just an inner drive to tell stories.
Well, some of the stories you tell are intrinsically interesting. I think you need to explain to people the story you told in Ice Age.
The Fabulous Ice Age is a documentary film that covers a 100-year history of dancing on ice and one man's quest to save the history. And the man who's trying to save the history is my uncle, Roy Blakey, and he is a former figure skater, professional figure skater. And through the years being a photographer, I would meet filmmakers and I would say, oh, you know, I have this great idea for a film. There's this, you know, the ice shows dominated live entertainment for four decades. Ice Follies started in St. Paul with Shipstads and and Johnson, and Morris Chalfant had Holiday on Ice, and it was based in Minneapolis for years. Tom Collins, who just passed, and his memorial was yesterday, started Champions on Ice. And so, and the Ice Capades used to open their West Coast shows in Duluth. And so Minnesota has always been a big hub for the ice shows. But my uncle has been collecting the history of the ice shows since he was 11 years wow. old, and now he's 89. And so as I met filmmakers, I was like, you need to think about doing this story. It's so great. And nobody ever did. And so I thought, okay, well, I have to figure out how to do it. And so I taught myself how to become a filmmaker in order to make that film. And that film is so inspirational for me because you see these artists who were – also driven by this desire to have this community and to live their passion, and they got to travel the world. And for many, even though that might have been just a short period of their life, it really defines their life. And forever they think of themselves as an ice show skater. And so I just feel really lucky to have had this entree into this world through my uncle, again, very family focused. And to be able to learn about this history and also to be able to meet all these amazing people.
So you learn to make a film, And when was this? How many years ago did you make
it? I started the film in 2006 and it premiered in 2013.
So you spent some time on this. It
took me a long time.
All right. I haven't seen it, unfortunately. Your description is wonderful.
You can see it on Amazon. It's available streaming. It was on Netflix for 5 years and they put it out in 10 languages,
wow.
which was really a miracle. It went all the way. It was all over Northern Europe, Canada, all throughout South America. And it really, I think it touched a lot of people.
Well, clarify this for me. It sounds like it's sort of a historical documentary, but it also sounds quirky.
Well, it's quirky because Roy is quirky, and he's the common thread that ties all of these time periods together. And he's in his 80s, he's 89, but all my friends say they want to be him when they grow up. He still rides his bicycle, and we still travel together. We're travel buddies, and he's just got the zest for life that you just want to be with him.
Carrie Pickett is a photographer, filmmaker, artist, and writer. She's in town for the opening reception for Trek Record, which will be Thursday from 4 to 7 at the MSU Moorhead Gallery in the Dill Center for the Arts. And Carrie, we've covered briefly photographer, filmmaker. We'll get back to filmmaker. How about this artist and writer piece?
Well, I'm very into books, and I really like sharing my photography with books. And so every single book I've been a part of, 3 books that have been published, and I always really like a lot of text. My first book, Love in the 90s, is about my grandparents, my uncle's parents, my mom's parents, and it's about their courtship and love letters. It's their year-long postal courtship from the 1920s, 1929, along with my photos of them doing their life together in their 90s.
So that the book is titled Love
in the
90s. Yeah, that's wonderful. And there's a very evocative photograph of these two people holding on to each other.
Yeah, the book was published by Warner Books in 1995, and it was, again, kind of a miracle because the first printing was 150,000 copies. And so for an artist to have her very first book have 150,000 copies, I think it speaks to the universality of the love represented in the photos and the universality of the desire for long-lasting love.
Well, the photograph, when I see it, and I think I'd like wish everyone could see it because it's very intimate, really. How did you take the photograph?
Well, I'm a cancer survivor. I came down with a bad case of Burkitt's lymphoma in my late 20s and left New York and moved back to Minnesota to have 2 years of chemotherapy treatments. And at that time, I also was involved in Native culture, and a medicine man told me that he felt that I needed to focus on people more needy than myself. And so I was photographing children coping with life-threatening illness. And when I would come home, I would go to my grandparents' house to visit with them, and I would finish off the roll of film at their house.
Wow.
And so in a way, my first book came from the tail ends of roles where I was just hanging out with my grandparents. And then after my grandpa died, I found this big box of love letters. And they had always talked about their year-long postal courtship and how a preacher had fallen in love with my grandma and she wasn't interested in him. She was also an ordained minister. And so how they had written each other every single day for a year, and all of a sudden I found this box of love letters and this story came to life. And so I would go over to the nursing home and I would put some letters in a baggie and I would go crawl into bed with my grandma and I would read her love letters. And she would say, "I feel just like that." And I would be like, "Yeah, grandma, that's you." And so I started going to photo festivals, and people would look at the photos, and as they were looking at my photos, I started reading them some love letters. And I just knew that it would be a good book. And so then eventually it did become my very first book.
But that photograph, again, they're in bed, they're embracing each other. It's not sexual. It's very warm. It's,
yes.
I just have this image of you hovering over them with a camera.
I'm literally hovering over them. I stood on the bed, and it was a snowstorm, and they got snowed in over it. We all got snowed in at my mom's at one Thanksgiving, and so they were in bed with my mom's bed, and the light at her. She had a light right by her bed. They didn't have a light. I have a photo like that. That I made at their house as well from the morning. This was at night.
Light is everything.
And it was something about the light.
Yeah.
And then it's just all the white, that she's in white and he's in white and he's wearing a worn thermal underwear shirt. And he's in the crook of her arm. You know, it's usually the other way around. But I think that it really touches on both of their vulnerability, but also you just feel their devotion and love to one another in the photo.
Well, you also referred to this Saving Body and Soul. Tell us the story behind that.
Saving Body and Soul actually came from an assignment. I was working for People magazine, and one of the reporters that I worked with a lot was Margaret Nelson. And for years, Margaret told me about Mary Jo Copeland and her work at Sharing and Caring Hands. And I didn't really go see her until I had an assignment. And after spending a couple of days with her, I said, we have to do a book about her. She's amazing. She's just got so much energy, and the way that she lives her value system is just so inspirational. And so we spent a couple of years, and I photographed her daily life and also did portraits of the people that she serves.
So this says something about the way you approach your work. It is the moment you're capturing, obviously, but you're spending some time getting to the moment.
Oh, yeah. I think that everything that's good takes time and a lot of work. And that's the same with photography. I'm not a person who's interested in posing and creating a moment. I'm really interested in being an observer and being able to show something that is the decisive moment in the words of Cartier-Bresson.
Let's talk about First Daughter and the Black Snake with Winona LaDuke. What got that project going? And tell the audience what it amounted to ultimately.
Well, I first met Winona back in 1983 when we were both 24 years old. And over the years, I have tried to be there to photograph a number of her milestone moments. Some of them have been for magazine assignments. I photographed her in 96 for People magazine. I did her portrait in 2001 when she was chosen as Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year. When she fought the genetic patenting of wild rice by the University of Minnesota, I went to the state capitol to see her work and went up to the reservation and started learning about the importance of wild rice. And so I've always been interested in what she's doing. And when I read in 2013 that the Sandpiper pipeline was going to be put right through her sacred wild rice territory and that she was going to a meeting about it, I knew that this would be an important story because of the sacredness of the wild rice in the Ojibwe culture. And so I just said, I want to see what's going on and what's happening. And so I filmed her second Love Water, Not Oil ride in 2014, and I cut together an hour-long version of that. And then I followed her to New York City to the People's Climate March, where 500,000 people walked down 6th Avenue worried about climate change. And the indigenous people were leading the march. And I kind of like a light bulb went off in my head, and I was like, okay, this is a little bit more than just one ride. And so I decided to really devote some time. And so I spent 2.5 years following Winona.
And the black snake here is the pipeline.
The black snake is the pipeline. The film follows her efforts. It follows her life, her mom, her family, and her community as they oppose the Sandpiper and Line 3. And so over that time, you just see how the people have come together and have been given an agency to participate in all of the different processes. I went to a million Public Utilities Commission meetings. You know, I mean, all of these people have really been looking at this issue for a very long time. And so as the years progressed, Winona kept doing her rides. And in 2016, at the end of her fourth year of riding the line, the Enbridge Corporation announced that they were going to not do the Sandpiper pipeline, and they instead invested in the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so then that was really the end of my story. But the line and the scoping meetings and much of the beginnings of Line 3 are also in my film.
When you make a film or you do a book, this is an artist process we've been talking about, but what about selling the book to a publisher or to a distributor for a film? Tell us about that process.
Well, I think that finishing anything is difficult, but then finding somebody else to believe in it and to take it out and to distribute it, it's all, you know, unless it has distribution, any book or film is not going anywhere. And so it's a process of luck and serendipity and hard work and perseverance. I think any time we talk about being an artist, persistence and perseverance has got to be right up there as one of your characteristics, or else you're not going anywhere.
Well, we've been talking about photography, filmmaking, writing, various artistic endeavors, but you also do oil and watercolor painting.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so this is where I've really gone crazy with this show, because I treated this show very differently because it was at my alma mater. And so I really wanted to show the students that even though I'm a photographer and a filmmaker, that I still do pastels, I still do watercolor, I'm still interested in oil. And so I'm showing that work that I've done over, you know, the last maybe a couple decades, just some samples of it for the very first time.
Okay.
And so I'm not really saying I'm just the best artist in that way, but I just want to let people know that it's okay to keep exploring in other medias.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on I have a couple of book projects in my little pack, and then I've got a couple more film ideas that I'm trying to work on, and then I'm for the very first time collaborating with another filmmaker. I'm in a group called the Film Fatales, and it's women who have directed feature films. I'm the new co-chair of the Minneapolis group. And I'm working with the director, Dawn Mickelson, and she chose me as her director of photography for a film about women in taiko drumming. So Thursday, I'm not going to be able to be at the opening because I'm flying to Japan to film for 12 days.
That's a very dramatic form of drumming.
The rock stars of taiko drumming in Japan, and that's an interesting And so that – and I have a lot on my do list.
All right. Well, Carrie Pickett, the 2018 Lifetime Achievement Award winner from MSU Moorhead School of Art, photographer, filmmaker, artist, and writer. Her opening reception for Track Record, that compilation of 40 years of her work so far, is Thursday from 4 to 7 at the gallery in the Dill Center for the Arts. And then you'll be screening the film First Daughter and the Black Snake with and about Winona LaDuke in the Weld Hall Auditorium Saturday, October 5th from 5 to 7:30. Thanks for spending some time with
us.
And
then there'll be a closing reception. That's where I'll be at, and that will be the big party.
All right. Good for you. Enjoy the party. Coming up, Natural North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. All of us here want to thank you as a member, and wrapping up our fall membership drive is a great time to do it. So thanks to you. You called or joined online, and of course you may be a sustaining member, as many people are now, and you don't even need to call. However you do it, your support keeps us going. I'll also thank Atomic Coffee, Red River Coffee, McDonald's, and Sandy's Donuts, and the volunteers who helped answer the phones. If you haven't done it, made a contribution, well, you can still call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org. Our listener supporters, you make it all possible. You do this, so this is here for you. So let's all thank each other for keeping it going.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is the author and voice of the Natural North Dakota essays you hear on Prairie Public. He's a naturalist who shares insights about the unique features of our state. Today, his essay is about a coal vein that burned for at least a century and a type of tree that grew in its fumes.
It's been a while since I last visited the burning coal vein and columnar junipers, but I recently had the opportunity to get reacquainted with them, and they didn't disappoint. Bands of lignite coal occasionally catch fire and burn for a time, but this burning coal vein, located some 15 miles north and west of Amadon, or around 30 miles south of Medora on East River Road, is a landmark. Ignited by lightning or perhaps a prairie fire, this burning coal vein, several feet below the ground, was first observed by white settlers in the area back in the 1880s. It continued to burn and smolder until late 1970s or perhaps the early 1980s. Even in the summer, visitors could feel the heat emanating from cracks in the ground below which the fire burned. And of course, there were the columnar junipers growing nearby. Rocky Mountain red cedar, Juniperus scapularum, often called juniper, generally has a rounded bushy form. But these had a columnar growth form. It was thought that gases released from the burning coal, particularly ethylene, was responsible for this interesting growth form. However, a study published in the Southwestern Naturalist in 1982 concluded that the columnar growth form was not entirely environmentally induced. However, since the fires went out, the juniper appear to have resumed their normal growth form. Downhill from the burning coal vein and columnar junipers is the burning coal vein campground. The burning coal vein and columnar junipers, as well as the campground, are on U.S. Forest Service land. The campground here is modest, but contains 10 or so campsites, each with a picnic table, fire ring, and parking spot. The campground also has a handicap-accessible toilet and potable water from a well with a hand pump. A modest camping fee of $8 per night is charged on the honor system. Every North Dakotan should visit the burning coal vein and columnar junipers at some time. And if you've been there before, they're still worth seeing again. Plus, the Mottahe Trail is nearby. So are a few thousand acres of ponderosa pine, the northeasternmost natural stand in the continent. So make a point to get reacquainted or acquainted with this piece of natural North Dakota in the near future. There's much to see, do, and learn here. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, the story behind a new inductee into the Native American Hall of Honor in Bismarck and a preview of a Soil and Water Summit in Medora. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Fargo police were called to a domestic situation just south of the NDSU campus last night after 10 p.m. The incident was reported at 1131 College Street North, across from the Farmhouse Fraternity. Police Chief Dave Todd says a man and a woman were outside arguing the house when the officers arrived.
While they were dealing with them, the male all of a sudden broke away and ran into the house. At which time we found out there was a protection order that existed and they were not supposed to be together. We've got some history with this male. We know who he is. We've dealt with him before.
Chief Todd says the man is known to have access to firearms, so police surrounded the neighborhood, called in Red River Valley SWAT, and told neighbors, including students, to stay away and shelter in place if needed while streets were shut down to traffic. Two girls, ages 3 and 9, were in the house. After repeated unsuccessful attempts to contact the man by phone and a bullhorn, police used a flashbang device in the hope that the man would come out of the house. A few minutes later, the children came out of the house on their own and reunited with their mother, who was with police a block away. SWAT entered the house but found the man was not there, and a search for the man is ongoing. And a Duluth-based energy company threw a party today in Glen Ullin to celebrate the impending opening of a new wind farm in Morton and Mercer counties. Here's Prairie Public's Dave Thompson with that story.
Thank you for joining us today as we celebrate the impending completion of the Glen Ullin Energy Center wind project.
Wells McGifford is the business development vice president for Elite Energy.
It's 106 megawatts in addition to the 500 megawatts that our company built at the Bison Wind Farm, culminating into nearly $1 billion of investment in the area.
The project has been in the works for more than 10 years. In addition to the wind, Elite has interest in North Dakota Lignite through its BNI coal subsidiary. It also is involved in carbon capture efforts in North Dakota. State Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson told the crowd, "It's an example of the state's policy of all the above when it comes to energy development.
We are starting to work together for the benefit of the state of North Dakota."
Elite Chairman and CEO Al Hodnick said this kind of energy development would not be possible without good landowner relations.
"Landowners are the currency value of renewables. Without quality landowner relations, we don't have renewables. We don't have coal mining. We don't have solar."
And company president Al Rudick says Elite is not done yet.
"We see the opportunity for more wind as we look at the partnerships we've developed here in the counties, and whether it's to the north, to the west, to the south, we see more opportunities for additional projects in the future."
Xcel Energy is buying the power the Glen Ullin Energy Center will produce. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And for Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. An induction ceremony was held earlier this month at the Native American Hall of Honor in the North Dakota Heritage Center. The Hall of Honor recognizes North Dakota tribal members who've gone above and beyond in representing their cultures. One of this year's inductees in the legendary category is Chief Little Shell III of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. The history of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa is unique, as they did not participate in the Treaty of Fort Laramie. 10 years earlier, in 1858, the tribe agreed to the Sweet Corn Treaty, which established over 10 million acres as Chippewa lands. In 1884, the United States reduced the size of the Turtle Mountain Reservation to 2 townships, or a little over 46,000 acres. In a video prepared by Makoche Studios of Bismarck, we hear from Les LaFontaine, tribal historian and faculty member at Turtle Mountain Community College, about the role Chief Little Shell played during this important period in tribal history.
Little Shell III is probably the most significant leader at Turtle Mountain. And the reason for that is that he was challenged at a time when the land base was being taken away or being threatened. Our tribe, actually, the Pembina Band of Chippewa, had occupied 10 million acres of north central North Dakota. He was a leader at the time when this was being taken over by the U.S. government. And there were European settlers moving into this area, claiming it as their territory. And so he was faced with that challenge of, how do I protect this homeland? How do I protect the way of life? When he became chief around the 1870s, our people were kind of losing that buffalo hunting culture. by the 1880s, of course, you know, most buffalo were nearly exterminated. So that whole way of life of hunting buffalo on the Great Plains was ending, and Loschel was the person who was the leader at the time. There was no reservation here, and he was a person who resisted the removal of the Turtle Mountain people from Turtle Mountain, and that was really all the doings of Loschel. This reservation really is here because of Loschel III. Loschel asked for a reservation here to recognize a reservation here because it was already our traditional land. It was not ceded to the U.S. government. We would not be here if it was not for Chief Loschel. I oftentimes look at, you know, the beautiful area here at Turtle Mountain. It's just an oasis, you know, in the middle of the prairie. It was a homeland. It was a winter place for Turtle Mountain people. But the reservation is really a credit of Loschel. Along with that, Loschel also fought to retain the 10 million acres that our tribe occupied here. In 1882, the original Turtle Mountain Reservation was about 24 by 36 miles, you know, encompassing most of Rolette County. So the reservation originally was, you know, pretty good size. But by 1884, there were two executive orders by President Chester Arthur reducing the reservation. And Loschel opposed that, and really, until the day he died, you know, he tried to restore the original boundaries of the reservation here. This was Loschel in a delegation, and Loschel is the person sitting right here. And you can see the Lincoln medallion that he's wearing. It's a peace medal that belonged to his father. But because he wore it, it was a sign that he was an important person. He actually went to Washington several times with the delegation, pleading for the just compensation for the Turtle Mountain people. There were attempts to remove the people from here to White Earth, Minnesota. In fact, there's a Pemina Township at White Earth reserved for the Turtle Mountain Pemina Chippewas. There was an attempt to move us to Fort Berthold. Again, Loschel refused to move to Fort Berthold, and so eventually by 1882, this place was recognized as a reservation. When he refused to sign that, well, then the U.S. government said, well, we're not going to feed you. You know, we're not going to provide you with support at these negotiations, which is oftentimes, you know, a process that was typical of any treaty gathering. Eventually, Loschel leaves Turtle Mountain and goes out to Montana, where there were still buffalo. He was recognized by the people here, especially by the Mixbloods. The Métis, the Michif people really revered Loschel. In fact, he had a grand council, so he was not an authoritarian. Being a chief, your word was your honor, and all that is really important. It's not like the authoritarian leadership in Europe, you know, where a king is king and he can do no wrong. It's kind of a different governance system. As a chief, you know, he always led the people in a good way, and so people followed him. As people will follow you if you make good decisions. And his father made those kind of decisions, and his grandfather. So in other words, he was always following, I'll say, the traditional values of the Anishinaabe people. Loschel rises up as one of the prominent ones, mostly because of his dedication to this place. When I say this place, I'm talking about Turtle Mountain. He did so much for the Turtle Mountain people in terms of recognizing the reservation, fighting for a way of life, really giving his life to make things better here for the people at Turtle Mountain. Great leaders around the world, you know, we think of them as people who gave of themselves for the people, and Loschel was one of those individuals. And he did it, you know, like his father did and his grandfather did. He's a remarkable, incredible leader that did extraordinary things for the people at Turtle Mountain.
Tribal historian Les LaFontaine. You can see all of the videos honoring members of the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor at vimeo.com/Makoche, M-A-K-O-C-H-E. Next on Main Street, a preview of a Soil and Water Summit tomorrow in Medora.
Next time on The Pulse, we know that there is a connection between our mood and our gut. Maybe you get hangry when you haven't eaten.
And I can't focus, and all I can think about is, like, get me a sandwich right now.
Or,
if I have an upset stomach, I'm going to be in a bad mood and annoyed and aggravated.
What are researchers learning about this connection?
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Lance Loken. He's the moderator for the Soil and Water Summit titled Back to the Badlands, which starts in Medora tomorrow. Thank you for joining us, Lance.
Good afternoon.
And also in our Bismarck studio, Alan Ashworth. He is a field tour leader for the upcoming summit. He's also a research professor with the NDSU Department of Geosciences and, for that matter, a well-known man in the field. So thank you for joining us also in our Bismarck studio.
Thank you.
Let's get right into it, Lance. So what is the purpose of the Soil and Water Summit?
Well, this is the third time we've had this conference. We space them roughly every 2 years. The goal of the summit is to provide a forum for dealing with soil and water issues tied to the energy industry, mostly the oil and gas industry, so that we end up drawing folks that are anything from landowners through oil industry folks, regulators, and from our agenda, we've got a really interesting and dynamic set of speakers set up. Tomorrow we start off with Connie Triplett. She's going to be talking about the new Davis Refinery going in near the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. We've got Jason Decker from the Forest Service. Dave Glott, the chief of the Department of Environmental Quality, is going to be talking about their programs related to the energy industry. We've got Derek Broughton with the Broughton Law Firm. He's going to be talking about landowner concerns related to impacts in the oil industry. We have Samantha Croach. She's, I believe, an NDSU graduate student or has graduated, and she's going to be talking on a site she did research on up in Montreal County. We've got Troy Coons representing the Northwest Landowners, and his group has been very active the last few legislative sessions attempting to get additional regulations in that benefit landowners and give them maybe a few more rights when it comes to dealing with the energy industry. And then on Thursday morning, Clay Jenkinson is going to be doing an hour and a half before the field trip. Everybody knows Clay. And then Professor Ashworth is going to lead us astray on a field trip. I believe we're going to try to get to the Petrified Forest. And we're leaving Bismarck yet today, and we're going to go out and kind of scope out locations beyond the Petrified Forest where Alan can educate people on how the Badlands formed, how the erosional forces created the landscape that we see, and a little bit of history for the attendees to give them a better feel for how the Badlands actually came into existence.
And Alan, give us a little of your purpose in being there. I mean, obviously, Lance just mentioned that you've got some scientific interest in the Badlands in particular, but why speak or deal with this particular group?
Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. One is that Lance is a good friend, and he was a student from many years back. And when he asked me if I would come out to the Badlands to take a field trip with this group, I jumped at the opportunity. The Badlands have always been a favorite place for me. When I came to the United States in 1969, and it was in the Thanksgiving of that year that I actually first saw the Badlands from the Painted Canyon Overlook. And it was an amazing thing for someone who'd come right out of Europe to just to see that landscape and to realize how different North America was to Europe in there. And it's always remained just a very favorite place, or somewhere very close to my heart. Over the years, I've got to learn quite a lot about it. And so the opportunity then to share that knowledge with this particular group, who are a very knowledgeable group, is a great thing for me to be able to be able to come out and do this.
The Soil and Water Summit, Back to the Badlands, is I guess a joint operation of the Soil and Water Conservation Society and the Professional Soil Condition Association of North Dakota, Lance?
Yeah, it's the Professional Soil Classifiers Association of North Dakota. That's the membership group for anybody can be a member of that. There's a number of us in the state that are registered professional soil classifiers. I have that distinction. And then the North Dakota chapter of the Soil and Water Conservation Society, they're the joint sponsors for this conference. I've been an officer. I've been on the board of directors with both groups through the years. Outreach and education, continuing education, especially for some of our members, is a critical thing. The goal of this conference is also to help with continuing education for the membership of the organizations, but we also open it up to the general public. So we'll have a wide variety of people attending the conference tomorrow in Medora.
It takes place at the Rough Riders Hotel Conference Center in Medora. How many people are you expecting?
I'm guessing somewhere between 40 and 60. I haven't seen the final numbers. I'm a life member of the TRMF, and I know Randy Hotson-Bueller fairly well, and they don't give us too deep of a cut in pay, but they make a great place to hold this kind of a conference. And this again is our third time at the TRMF at the Rough Rider in Medora. It's a great venue. Weather looks like it might be a little dicey maybe tonight, but I think by Thursday, other than it might be a little breezy, our field trip should come off without a hitch.
TRMF is the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Correct.
One of the items you mentioned, Lance and Alan, is this very big spill that occurred in Montreal County back in 2013. It famously flooded a wheat field that they're still trying to remediate the soil there. What's the update on that spill? And I think it's the largest in the state's history. Is that wheat field usable?
To be honest, I'm not up to speed on that. Now, I own Western Plains Consulting. We're an environmental and natural resources consulting firm, and I've probably worked on over 100 spills out in western North Dakota in the oil patch, but I haven't worked on this particular spill. I know Samantha will be giving us an update on that, tomorrow afternoon.
Well, what is typically involved in fixing the soil after a spill like this?
I would rather clean up crude oil. You can see it. It doesn't soak into the soil as much. If it does get on water, it floats. You can skim it off. The saltwater spills, I've got my master's in wetland soils from Jim Richardson at NDSU after I finished my undergraduate work in Allen's department. And my master's work dealt with how salts move across the landscape from recharge through flow through into discharge wetlands. Little did I realize that it would become critical in my career. The problem with salt water is in North Dakota, whether you're East River or West River, even though we're a semi-arid state, we've got pretty high groundwater, often within 5 to 10 to 12 feet. So the problem with the salts, now like if you're down in Oklahoma or Texas where groundwater is really deep, you can flush the salts down below the rooting zones. That doesn't typically work in North Dakota because it gets down to the water, and NDSU, Franzen, I can't remember his first name, back in 2013, published a study that a lot of us in soils kind of suspected. Salts can rise in a sandy soil roughly 2 feet by capillary action. It can rise in silty soils up to 9 feet by capillary action. In clayey soils, it can come up 15 feet. So the problem you've got in western North Dakota and a lot of these areas, whether you're East or West River, you've got clay-based soils. And so you can't push the salts deep easily, if at all. So if your thought is to just scrape off the surface and bring in new soil, it'll look good for a few years. But I've come out on sites where they've done that, and 4 or 5 years later, the salts have risen by capillary action. There's nothing growing. So you're basically stuck, in my opinion. There isn't very many, if any, amendments at work on salt because you're still going to have the sodium. You're still going to have the chloride. They're very mobile. They'll move laterally. And the environmental fate on these are very difficult to predict. So, unfortunately, the best way to get rid of this is you dig it out of one hole, haul it to a regulated facility, a landfill, and put it in another hole. And then you need to go out and source suitable backfill materials and then restore and reclaim a site that way. It becomes incredibly expensive. I know for a fact oil companies hate to have these things happen because it's a drag on their bottom line. And they don't really like hiring folks like us to come in because this is an expensive proposition to do these saltwater cleanups. Crude oil cleanups are a lot easier. The stuff is thicker. It doesn't flow very far. unless it's on a steep slope, and then you can get in front of it. So, you know, when it comes to saltwater releases, that can have some incredibly dramatic and catastrophic effect. And that's where the Northwest landowners come in. Several of their members have had to deal with saltwater spills that have impacted their private property.
And saltwater or produced water is a byproduct of the fracking process that is commonly used in that part of the state.
Correct.
Alan, what would the Badlands field trip entail?
Weather depending. We're going to try to get out to an area that's on the west side of the south unit of Theodore Roosevelt Park. It's known as Petrified Forest, and it's a very beautiful area. There are numerous large petrified trees out there. And the geology that is represented there is really very, very typical of the Badlands. And so the purpose is just to, with this group, is to, these are people who are all involved with environmental type issues. But we come out to the Badlands, and it's to remind people how the Badlands themselves then, what their origins are, what the source of the sediments were, what the environments were like at the time that the sediments were accumulating, and then subsequently how the Badlands themselves have formed in there. So that would be the main purpose of the field trip is just educational for the and probably a little bit of a deeper look at the formation of the Badlands than maybe some of the people there might have had.
And reminding them that they're a unique geologic formation in our state and that they are, I guess, in a somewhat vulnerable place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was the North Dakota Badlands are one of the North America's really wonderful wild places, and of course, with all this industrial activity that has developed in the last 20 years in our state, areas like the Badlands have just become under increasing pressure, and so. It's a reminder then to people that how special these areas are to us and how we need to conserve them for the future.
You reminded us that you got your PhD 50 years ago and you are a distinguished emeritus professor at NDSU besides being a research professor in the Department of Geosciences. So you're getting a big award in Phoenix pretty soon, right?
Pretty soon, yeah.
Well, what is it?
There's a division of the Geological Society of America that is referred to as Quaternary and Geomorphology. And they have a Distinguished Career Award, and they selected me to be this year's awardee, which is, from my point of view, is a great honor for me to be selected into that position, and particularly when I look at the list of other people who have held that position. So I was extremely surprised when I got an email to say that they've made this award to me. So,
So it's just, I guess, a measure of the quality of the presentations that will be given at the Soil and Water Summit, Back to the Badlands, which starts tomorrow in Medora. And Lance Loken, the moderator, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Alan Ashworth will be leading the field tour into the Badlands, and we should also mention that if you research a little bit about Alan Ashworth, not only is he a distinguished emeritus professor, but he has a glacier named after him in Antarctica. Thank you for spending some time with us as well.
That's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
All right. Are we clear?
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, celebrating September as the month Theodore Roosevelt arrived in Medora in 1883, inviting guests to hear a Theodore Roosevelt reprise at the Old Town Hall Theater each night at 7:30 p.m. through September. Explore it, adore it, Medora.
Teachers, are you tired of boring professional development? Looking for something new to spark inspiration for your classroom? Prairie Public, along with the Southeast Education Cooperative, Central Regional Education Association, and EduTech, bring you EdCamp North Dakota.
One time at EdCamp?
Join us October 17th in Fargo for this free dynamic learning event for all educators. Continuing education credit is available. Learn more and register today at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 17th.
As the American frontier became more settled, towns of the Great Plains were determined to present themselves as refined and cultured. The construction of hotels, churches, and restaurants represented an oasis of civilization and attracted new settlers. The Opera House was the crowning glory for many Western towns. Although it's doubtful that operas were performed very often in these venues, the term was preferred over theater. The opera was considered highly respectable, while the theater was seen as low class and disreputable. Opera houses across the American West were often built on the second floor of a structure with shops and restaurants below. Since the opera houses attracted visitors, they were considered good for business. In 1878, Bismarck opened a facility that included a courtroom, a faro bank, a saloon, and a theater. As one old-timer remarked, it was thus that without undue exertion, one could litigate, speculate, irrigate, or be entertained according to his own tastes or needs. Larger opera houses included space for additional recreation. The Homestake Opera House in Leeds, South Dakota, offered a large ballroom and bowling alleys. On this date in 1903, the citizens of Langdon learned that their opera house was almost ready to open. Mr. McCune had invested $20,000 to build it. The bricklayers and masons had completed their work, and the contractor promised to turn the building over to the owner no later than October 20th. Tickets had already gone on sale for opening night, and early sales amounted to over $900. There were 8 boxes, each seating 6 people. These sold for $60 each. Prices for single seats ranged from $3.50 to $7.50. Opera houses were usually the most lavish and ornate building in town. The Metropolitan Opera House in Grand Forks was described as a wonder of ivory, blue, and gold, with 2 balconies, velvet draperies, and upholstered seats in Baroque style. In Jamestown, the theater curtain of Lloyd's Opera House displayed a vivid scene of Rome. The Langdon Opera House is long gone, but it served an important purpose, just as so many others did in small towns across the Great Plains. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
China is using social media to recruit spies in America.
We had last year 3 traditional espionage cases, all involving ex-intelligence community officers going at the same time. That's unprecedented.
How are national security officials in the U.S. battling the threat of economic espionage?
We are looking at the behavior of the Chinese government.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, archaeology professor Renita Dahlin of Minnesota State Moorhead will join us to talk about her study of an ancient Louisiana site where she uses ground-penetrating radar. And Buck Paulson is recording the 20th season of Painting with Paulson at Prairie Public. And years ago, we visited with Buck about how he got into art. And tomorrow, we'll replay that conversation. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.